Hinterfragt.
Der Ethik-Podcast.
Welcome to our podcast with Bill Scheuermann on whistleblowing. Due to our international guest, it will be in English.
The moral decision to tell the public about spying that affects all of us has been costly, but it was the right thing to do, and I have no regrets.
This sentence is part of a statement which Edward Snowden gave to human rights groups at Moscow Airport on Friday, July 12th in 2013, after he had made public the secret NSA spying activities. Whether and under what circumstances such an act of whistleblowing is morally legitimate will be the topic of today's podcast, and we are very happy to have Bill Scheuermann joining us.
Bill Scheuermann is a professor and graduate director at the Department of Political Science at Indiana University Bloomington. He has published several pieces on civil disobedience and whistleblowing, including an article on the case of Edward Snowden in Philosophy and Social Criticism, as well as a piece on the anti-legal turn in recent theories of civil disobedience that was published in the Journal of Political Philosophy. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Bill, Edward Snowden is a hero to some, a traitor or a criminal to others. What's your take on his case?
Well, I think he's a hero in every respect that I think is significant. He is a deeply conscientious political actor. He's one of the most amazing political actors I think you've seen in the political scene coming out of my country in many years. I don't know if you know this, but he basically has educated himself. He went to an American high school, never went to a university, but has clearly read, as far as I can tell, many of the great texts about civil disobedience and has clearly modeled his actions on some of these great figures in not just American history, obviously in global history, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and so on. So I think he's very much a hero, yes.
You said that he was motivated by moral considerations, but I guess even if we assume that's correct, many people will say, well, people can't just break the law because they think it's the right thing to do. So is all conscientious lawbreaking legitimate?
No, I don't think all conscientious lawbreaking is legitimate. And this is one reason why Snowden is so interesting. He clearly has thought very hard about the special tests that one has to pass in order for such actions to be considered legitimate, and he has done so, or at least he's tried to do so. So his action was public. He made a public justification about what he's doing. He's speaking to a public. He has said this, and therefore it has to be a public action, and he has to provide a justification. He identified himself, and this is actually very interesting because there are many groups today, and perhaps we can talk about this, which are not identifying themselves. And those are very difficult cases, I think. But Snowden, in a way which I think Martin Luther King or John Rawls would have recognized, argued from the very beginning, I have to let people know who I am. He tried to minimize harm. He did that in many different ways, despite the fact that he's been accused of opening the door to terrible violence. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. He's not accepted the penalties for his actions, and that's perhaps something we can talk about. I think he's provided some good reasons why, given his situation, it's not necessary for civil disobedience to, in fact, have to accept legal penalties for what they have done.
Let's talk about these different conditions in turn. You said that for something to count as civil disobedience, it has to be public. Now, there's a number of groups here in Europe, but probably also in the US, that do provide some kind of public justification for what they do, but don't identify themselves with names. Would that also count as a public action?
I think it's very complicated. I think it's very, very complicated. I think that if one wants to do what traditionally is called civil disobedience, okay, if one wants to stick to this model which emerged in the 1960s and 70s, I mean, it obviously has earlier predecessors, but I think developed most clearly at that point, and then became a sort of worldwide model, I think the publicity standard needs to be taken seriously. However, there are types of leaking, there are types of whistleblowing, which are not civil disobedience, should not be considered civil disobedience, and where the publicity requirement arguably should be relaxed. One has to talk about that. But I think there are situations in which there is plenty of room for protesters to not act in a public way. Snowden did so. And I think in a way, he's an easy case, although many people don't see it that way. Many people think he's a traitor. I don't. But I think he's an easy case in terms of talking about whistleblowing, because his whistleblowing does meet the conventional definition of civil disobedience, but perhaps it doesn't always have to.
Let me stick for a second to this publicity aspect. Why is it that it's so important? Because you said sometimes people might not be able to act publicly, and we can think of the case of people freeing animals. They wouldn't be able to do so if they said we are going to do that. So what is it about the publicity that's so important?
Yeah, I guess two things come to mind just very quickly. One thing is, I do think the publicity standard is crucial if one is going to try to convince one's fellow citizens that one's actions are legitimate. And to the extent that civil disobedience is not just morally conscientious action, it's morally conscientious action which is about changing public opinion, the publicity standard is important. The second thing that comes to mind is I think there's a lot of confusion about this publicity standard. And I think this is where we have to go back and basically blame some of these liberal philosophers who wrote about civil disobedience. So, for example, the idea which people find in Rawls that one has to announce the action ahead of time, perhaps even warn the police, I mean, that seems to me to be a very truncated interpretation of what this publicity condition requires. And a lot of the criticisms today in the debates that are taking place, I mean, my friend Robin Selicates, I know you interviewed him, he's been worried about this publicity condition. And I think his concerns really are about the narrow way in which they've often been understood. You know, even anonymous. I mean, that's a very interesting thing that's going on. Because yes, I mean, the particular individuals are oftentimes, it's hard to figure out who they are, although some people say one can do that. So in that sense, there's not, you know, the publicity conditions not being met, but they are making, the group is making very public statements about what they're doing. You know, that in a way does arguably meet that condition. So I think you have to, you know, think about it as it's a normative standard, but it's a normative standard that can take a lot of different forms, and we shouldn't forget that.
Let me get to another aspect. Edward Snowden made public severe violations of individual rights. How wrong does a law or a public policy have to be in order to justify civil disobedience?
Yeah, that's also tough. I mean, I think if you believe that we are living in a more or less functioning liberal democracy, okay, that's what, I mean, if you read Rawls again, that's what he talks about, almost just societies. That's what he has in mind. You know, then the burden should be pretty high because the idea is that people have other opportunities to bring about political change. Now, if you believe, as I have to say, I believe many times, that we do not live in well-functioning liberal democracies, you know, our political systems do not seem particularly responsive, then I think the bar legitimately is a lot lower. Then I think one doesn't have to wait for severe violations because, frankly, the political system's not working. I mean, if you think about this in the European context, I mean, not to be too polemical, but you have a sort of European-wide system which is not very democratic right now. It's pushing through austerity programs. It's engaging in neoliberal politics. Many people in Europe do not feel empowered to do much about this. At the European level, they don't feel empowered by any means. It seems to me the bar then should be very low for forms of protest directed against policies people think are wrong.
It still sounds like you say, well, you have to have some major injustice or lack of democracy for civil disobedience to be legitimate. Now, let me make an example that is kind of harmless. People in a city, I don't remember where, thought there weren't enough bike lanes and they went out and painted bike lanes themselves. Now, probably those who did that themselves won't say, well, that's because we have a severe lack of democracy or a human rights violation, but they would still claim, well, that's a form of civil disobedience. Are they wrong?
Yeah, I think it depends. I mean, again, civil disobedience refers to a type, as I was saying, politically motivated, morally conscientious action. It's directed at changing public policy, and it has, and I think it should have, certain conditions we associate with it. To say that is not to say that's the only legitimate form of protest, illegal or otherwise. Clearly not. So, for example, I mean, I don't know anything about this example, but you know, if you think of leaking or whistleblowing, as I was saying before, I think sometimes the standards may be very different. I'll just give you one example that's on my mind right now. It seems to me some of these leakers and whistleblowers who've been inspired by Snowden, right, and they're getting really punished very severely in my country, what's really interesting is that they're actually targeting private corporations. And it seems to me that's a very different thing from when you're targeting public authorities. I mean, there's a great essay by Michael Walzer from 1969, which I just reread. I read it a long time ago. And he was talking about labor upheavals in the U.S. in the 30s. And his point was, look, if you look at this model of civil disobedience developed by Martin Luther King, it could not justify some of these often violent labor uprisings that the U.S. had and basically made the welfare state in the U.S., you know, the welfare state we have possible. And his claim was very interesting. He says, look, these were people targeting private companies, which are acting in autocratic ways, where you don't have anything like democracy, you know? And if civil disobedience is, as Rawls argued, a form of protest that's suited to basically well-functioning, more or less well-functioning liberal democracies, when you're targeting institutions which are not liberal democracies, maybe you should have a lot more room to engage in forms of protest which are very militant and are frankly very messy sometimes. And maybe that's, I mean, I guess I'm circumventing your question in a way, but I don't mean to, but maybe, you know, the example you mentioned might be one like that. You'd have to look more carefully at it.
Provided I fulfill all these other requirements, is it sufficient that I personally believe the law to be wrong, or do I have to fulfill some additional objective standards in order for my civil disobedience to be justified?
It's a tough question. I think that's the point of this traditional model of civil disobedience, that it's not enough for me just to feel the law is unjust. I have to, by meeting these various conditions, by making arguments publicly, by acting in a nonviolent way, and so on, one is speaking to others, and also that one is trying to show that one fundamentally is committed to not the reality of the law, but the principle of legality. So part of me wants to say, not part of me, but I think the answer has to be no. The danger with just saying no is we do have these examples of these, you know, excuse the cliche, great individuals who said, I can't do this, you know, ich kann ja nicht anders, and I'm not going to do it. And, you know, nonetheless, Thoreau is another example. I think Snowden's an example. I mean, he's very interesting. I think he sat in front of his computer and his conscience really bothered him and decided he had to do something, even surprised his girlfriend. She was stunned. So he didn't even talk with her, you know. I mean, it's really amazing that he could do this. But nonetheless, even people like that have tried to make public arguments and have tried to show that this means something for the rest of us. So there are still some other conditions, I think.
You've mentioned a number of criteria for civil disobedience that Edward Snowden has met. There's one criterion that's often mentioned in literature that he hasn't met, namely he hasn't faced the court and he has evaded his punishment. Is that a problem?
I've struggled with this because it's also very complicated. Now, if you look at the reasons why various people, both activists and then philosophers, have claimed you have to accept legal penalties, they turn out to be very complicated again. And I think, again, there's a fundamental normative idea which then, unfortunately, gets reduced to this kind of textbook thing you have to do. And the normative ideal, which I think is very important, is to say, I respect the principle of legality. I recognize we live in a pluralistic society, which means I can't simply say, I don't like this law. It goes against my moral beliefs. Okay, that does not suffice in our day and age because we live where people have different moral views. If we all did that, then we really would have a problem, right? So the idea behind this punishment criterion is to say, I'm showing my fundamental respect for some shared system of legality under which we live and which we all should participate in making. And then what kind of happens if you read these texts again, I think maybe I'm wrong about this, but this is how I read them, that gets reduced to this very simple idea, aha, you have to be willing to accept legal penalties for your actions. And I think we should worry a little bit about that reduction because there clearly are cases in which it doesn't make sense. And I just very briefly on Snowden, I mean, Snowden has never in principle said that he should not face legal penalties. This is very interesting. Another way in which I think he's very thoughtful. What he has said, and I think he's absolutely right about this, is the way in which my government, the U.S. government, is trying to prosecute him is under the auspices of a terrible piece of Notstandsgesetzgebung, the Espionage Act, coming out of World War I. which is a horribly repressive piece of legislation, which makes a mockery of basic legal virtues. It's open-ended, it invites prosecutorial discretion. And he has correctly said, if I allow myself to face charges under that law, I'm contributing to the mockery of legality, not towards strengthening it. Again, Snowden, he understands taking legality seriously is what counts. And he's saying, in my case, facing penalties is not consistent with my attempt to uphold the principle of legality. That's a very sophisticated position.
That's interesting. If I understand you correctly, you say, well, we have to keep this idea that civil disobedience is an act in the spirit of the law, but it might not imply facing punishment. Now, there's a couple of people in the debate who say we should give up this idea that civil disobedience has to be in the spirit of the law anyways, because, I mean, people like Gandhi, did they really act in the spirit of colonial law? What is your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, and this is where I disagree with some of the, I think, very, very interesting people who are writing about this today. I do think what's interesting, certainly about civil disobedience, and that, you know, and again, you might want to separate that from other forms of illegal protest, you know, leaking, right? I think what I'm going to say probably applies to them as well, but one would have to then look at the specifics. But no, I think, again, you know, living in a pluralistic society means, I think, that we need to accept the principle of legality. We can't simply say conscience suffices. It just doesn't work, and it shouldn't work to simply say my conscience suffices. I can break whenever I want the law because I disagree with it. It's not just that's a recipe for anarchy. I'm not sure it's a recipe for anarchy, but it's a way I disrespect my fellow citizens. We are all colleagues in a legal community. So I do think this notion of legality is crucial. Having said that, I think it's a mistake, and this is where it also gets, I think, very interesting. If you look at the debate, what I just said, Martin Luther King said. Martin Luther King many times made these very legalistic claims about what his form of civil disobedience entailed. And he also said things like, we need a system change. We need revolutionary change. And I found this very interesting because I think he understood respecting the principle of legality is not the same thing as saying I'm supporting the political and social status quo. And in this debate, I'd say both liberals writing about civil disobedience and both radicals writing about civil disobedience, I think, miss that. So the liberals will say, yes, one has to accept this principle of legality, and that means you're accepting the constitutional status quo. All right? So civil disobedience is not about radical change. And then radicals, in a weird way, will often do the same thing. The consequence they draw, however, is a very different one. They say, well, therefore, all that legal stuff, let's get rid of that, because we want to model a civil disobedience which generates radical change. It's a long story, but last summer I was rereading a lot of Martin Luther King thinking about this, and I found he was extremely insightful in terms of understanding how arguments about legality can, in fact, have very, very radical consequences. The principle of legality, again, it's an abstract principle which doesn't have to determine your loyalty to the existing legal system, particularly when that legal system violates the principle of legality, when it's filled with arbitrary, discretionary decision-making which favors power holders over citizens.
To really understand that, we have to better understand what legality means in this context. It can't be the system which we have, because that wouldn't allow radical change. So does it mean more than morality then in the end?
Yeah, it's a really difficult question, and I have to admit I'm still struggling with this. And here's one reason why it's difficult, is if you look at people like King, who saw legality as potentially being quite radical. Another example, I just came across this, the radical abolitionists in my country, opponents of slavery, they also were very legalistic. We get a lot of that in the United States. They're also very radical. You know, they wanted an overthrow of the 19th century slave republic, essentially. And they thought you could both be legalistic and radical as well. In both the case of the radical abolitionists, the opponents of slavery, and in King, a lot of the arguments are natural law arguments. They are arguments which are indeed, you know, it's a highly ethical, moralized notion of law. Now, again, as you heard me say, I think we live in, I hope we live in a pluralistic society. Those arguments become problematic. I also can't just say, oh, my view of natural law is whatever. everyone should live like we live here in Prenzlauer. That's the Prenzlauer Berg principle of natural law. That's not going to work. It's not going to work in Indiana, I'll tell you that. So, you know, so that's not going to do it. So you need to have a conception of legality which isn't ethically and morally overloaded in that way. And the argument I tried to make, and maybe it doesn't work, is to say, even if one takes a more minimal conception of legality, if one focuses on these conventional legal virtues, generality in the law, equality before the law, clarity, publicity, and so on, I think that idea of law itself can oftentimes pose a challenge to the existing political and social order. The guy who made this argument, it's Martin Luther King makes that argument, I think, and also another person I'll just mention, the name is the Frankfurt theorist Franz Neumann, who wrote a really interesting piece on civil, he doesn't call it civil disobedience, but it's on basically conscientious lawbreaking from the 50s. And he has a sort of textbook notion of the rule of law. And his argument is that in contemporary societies, which he thought were deeply unjust, that model of the rule of law is being violated all the time. And the point for him is that, therefore, it does provide a lot of room for political and social criticism. Now, that's a controversial claim. There's no question about that.
We're getting near the end of this podcast, so maybe let's switch perspective for a last question. Until now, we have talked about those who practice civil disobedience. Now, let's talk about the state. If you were an advisor to the Obama government, how should they deal with whistleblowers like Edward Snowden, ideally?
Well, this has been a huge political disappointment. Obama has meant a shift politically, yes, in many ways, versus the conservative governments we have had. There's no question about that. But here you see the continuities, just to put it bluntly, of the national security state. And I think it's been a real, real mistake. As you probably have heard, he has tried to prosecute more people under this terrible piece of legislation than all other presidents combined. I mean, most presidents stayed away from this law because it's been very controversial, using the Espionage Act. It's been very controversial. Nixon tried to do it against Daniel Ellsberg, and then he and his guys broke the laws trying to spy on Ellsberg, and a judge threw the case out of court. And that was, people thought that might be the end of it. And Obama has just, I mean, there's a very interesting conception of executive power, I think Obama has, where he really believes that these government agents have to keep their mouth shut. And the problem with that, is, as Snowden understood, is it opens the door to all sorts of terrible things happening. So, I don't know what I would do in that. I mean, this is why I would never be able to be the president of the United States, but I would think we need to take apart the national security state and rethink American foreign policy. Until that happens, I am, unfortunately, somewhat pessimistic that you're going to see major improvements in terms of how my government's acting in response to these protesters. And that's really unfortunate, because Edward Snowden has made a huge contribution to not just democratic debate, but also in terms of getting people to think about what legality requires in a society that at least claims to be a decent society.
Well, thank you very much for this interesting conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Sie hörten eine Folge von Hinterfragt, dem Ethik-Podcast mit Anna Goppel und Andreas Gasse.
Sämtliche Folgen des Podcasts finden Sie auf unserer Homepage unter www.ethik.uzh.ch/hinterfragt.